I once stood on the runway where the Enola Gay took off to bomb Hiroshima. It was on a little island called Tinian, next to Saipan in the Pacific. Tinian had been held by Japan until July 1944, a year before the war ended. In that last year of World War II, American troops invaded, took over, and made that little island's airstrip the busiest in the world at that time.
During a major operation, one B-29 would leave each runway every 15 seconds until all 200 were in the air. And there was never a takeoff in which at least one plane did not crash on takeoff. So every mission had deaths.
This is Tinian-based military historian Don Farrell. He told me that when U.S. troops came to Tinian, they noticed that it was about the same shape as Manhattan. Mostly meadows and fields, but about the same shape as Manhattan.
And so they designed all the roadways, aligned them the same way, and named them the same. So you're on Broadway. 42nd and Broadway. So Times Square. Welcome to Times Square.
And this is Tinian native Deborah Fleming. She takes tourists around, and sometimes the occasional wayward journalist. She took me in her pickup to the airstrip where the Enola Gay took off.
Here we are. We're on runway Able. This is the end of the runway. Western end.
So now we're going at speed down the runway, the same way they went when they were about to take off to drop the atomic bomb on Hiroshima.
The runway now is eerily quiet. Tufts of weeds grow where bombers once taxied. Deborah, like most Tinian residents, is a U.S. citizen with sons who have served in the U.S. military. I ask how it feels to be living here in this place with its atomic legacy.
That's a very interesting question. No one's ever asked that. But I think there's a general disconnection. Growing up, we knew it was a great event. I didn't know about the catastrophe until, much later on in life. And then I did go to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I couldn't finish the tour. It was so, so sad.
In the decades since those bombs dropped, Tinian has had its share of visitors, U.S. veterans who believe the planes that took off from here helped save lives and shorten the war, and Japanese visitors who live with their own memories. President Obama's visit to Hiroshima seeks to bridge such divided memories. His critics protest that this gesture will make the United States look weak. But will it? Or is facing the past actually a sign of strength, perhaps even of moral leadership?
I really admire the political courage of President Obama to visit Hiroshima.
Yoichi Funabashi is a leading Japanese journalist and now head of a think tank. I talked to him in Tokyo for one of my previous podcasts. Here, he's speaking at Stanford University.
Too often we have seen governments, any governments, trying to whitewash their past, unwillingness to face up to the inconvenient truth.
Past is prologue, and how you face history can shape your future. This is Whose Century Is It? I'm Mary Kay Magstad. So, what do you remember as a society, and what do you choose to forget? Who gets to decide? And how does all of this shape a society's identity, its priorities, its sense of purpose and possibility? I was long based as a foreign correspondent in China, where the Communist Party knows the power of shaping the past. In schools, in the state-run media, you won't find mentions of the Tiananmen massacre or details about the Great Famine that killed 30 to 40 million people due to bad policies. Try talking about them on your own on social media, and you might find your account closed. You might even be detained. What the party does play up is Japanese atrocities in China before and during World War II. In fact, in a three-hour nationally televised parade last September, China's victory over Japan was the resounding theme. Even though the Communist Party wasn't in power then, and Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang, or nationalist government, won only with significant help from U.S. forces, in part because it was fighting a two-flank war. It was trying to keep the communist insurgents at bay while also fighting the Japanese. Of course, every society has its own way of dealing with a troubled past. South Africa had its extraordinary post-apartheid truth and reconciliation process. Rwanda, post-genocide, had something similar with its village-level gachacha trials. But in Cambodia, which I covered for years, Khmer Rouge perpetrators and their victims have lived for decades in uneasy détente. An expensive UN-funded tribunal has taken almost two decades and $200 million to try five aging Khmer Rouge leaders and convict three. There isn't much of a shared feeling among victims of the Khmer Rouge that justice has been served. There isn't even a shared narrative of what happened under the Khmer Rouge and why. In the United States, we have a national narrative about the Civil War, but if Northerners go to the South, they might find that some things are remembered differently. In Japan, too, divided memories of a traumatic past reverberate. My colleague, Patrick Cox, at the PRI radio program The World, which co-produces this podcast and where I was a foreign correspondent for years, has done some extraordinary work over the past decade on how Japanese in Hiroshima remember the bombing there. You can find all of those stories at PRI.org/Hiroshima. Let me share one with you, which Patrick did last August, to mark the 70th anniversary of the bombing. It's a reminder that beyond all the talk of policy and strategy and let's end the war early pragmatism, there were people, individuals, human lives lost and scarred. Here's a story about one of them who's making her own efforts to bridge divided memories in America, in Japan, and between generations. Over to you, Patrick.
I first met Sueko Hada 10 years ago, just before the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima. She told me her story then, what happened to her on the morning of August 6, 1945, about the flash of light, the huge explosion, and how, in an instant, the rest of her family ceased to exist. Mother, father, four sisters, all except for her, a seven-year-old child. Hada was at home with her sisters that morning. The family home collapsed, leaving them trapped.
Eventually, I managed to claw my way out from under the rubble. By now, our house was on fire and the cries of my sisters were getting fainter. I left to look for help. When I went outside, I saw that everything had totally changed. Although it had been a beautiful morning, it looked like twilight now. Everyone was injured, badly injured. No one was helping other people. They just looked after themselves. I myself was bleeding from a neck wound. There was blood all over the white clothes I was wearing. I wanted to return to the house, but I got lost. The landscape had totally changed. I didn't know which way to go. The only thing I could do was to follow the other injured people. Still to this day, my sisters' voices haunt me. I can hear them saying, "Please, call for help." That's the most painful thing, that I ran away from my sisters. I've felt guilty about this since that day. I'll feel guilty as long as I live. I'll never be happy.
Hada told me more, much more, about other terrible things that befell her or that she witnessed in the hours, days, and years after the blast. At times, she went into graphic detail of deaths that she witnessed, from burns, from radiation sickness, quick deaths, slow deaths. She also spoke of her unhappy upbringing by relatives who scolded her when she cried, telling her she was the lucky one to have survived. And listening to Hadar that day 10 years ago were her family members, her daughter and two granddaughters. Earlier this summer in Hiroshima, I met them again, minus one of the granddaughters. More about her later. In the intervening decade, Hadar has become used to telling her story publicly, usually on a stage in front of hundreds of people. Like many Hiroshima survivors, she has in her later years broken her silence, her mission to bear witness. Even though she's told her story scores of times, she can still be tripped up.
Sometimes a memory comes to me out of the blue, right while I'm telling my story and I catch my breath. "Oh, that happened," I tell myself. And I make a note of it so I can include it next time I speak.
4 years ago, Hadar visited the United States and spoke to audiences in Washington, Boston, and elsewhere.
America の方が
Americans listened intently to what I had to say. One time, a young person approached me saying, "I'm sorry," and gave me a hug. I was very moved. I thought, these Americans were good people, and it was only the war that made our nations fight each other.
It's never easy for Hadar to tell her story, whether to Americans or Japanese, but speaking to strangers is manageable. It's a million miles from the intimacy of a one-on-one conversation with a family member.
When I make a public speech, I just tell my story as it happened and say how I felt. But with my family, I really, really don't want the kids to hear all the gruesome details. It was such a terrible experience. So to them, I end up telling an edited version of the story. When my daughter and I talk about it, we tend to be too shy to talk frankly. It's only in the last year or two that she started asking questions about my experience.
Hadar says that Hiroshima's authorities are trying to recruit more so-called memory keepers, second and third generation survivors, who'll tell the story of their older relative once the relative has died. With her own daughter sitting just a few feet away, Hadar tells me how torn she is about this. She desperately wants her daughter to become a memory keeper, and at the same time, she wants to shield her from the pain that she herself has suffered. This is when things get a bit much. Hadar is surrounded by a loving, supportive family, something that she lacked for so long. I ask her about the granddaughter who isn't in the room, Yuko. This is what happened to her. Not long after I first met the family 10 years ago, Yuko went to a party thrown by a friend of hers, a friend who was married to an American. There's a Marine Air Corps station close to Hiroshima. At the party, Yuko met a U.S. Marine. They dated, they got married, and after a few years, they moved to the United States.
At first I thought, why does it have to be an American guy? But now I think it's a good thing. I'm hoping that Yuko will become a bridge between Japan and the U.S. She's not a very social type, but she's trying so hard to communicate with Americans and to fit in. I've seen a video of her trying to do that at a party. It makes me think that one day I could go to one of those parties at her house and speak to the people there as the grandmother of Yuko. Instead of making a speech to strangers from a stage, I could just tell my story to them.
When I moved to America, I feel so guilty, so guilty. I just didn't want to talk to grandma. So guilty.
I went to visit Yuko in Colorado Springs, where she now lives. She talks regularly with her grandmother.
Her character and my character is exactly the same. She thinks that way, I think that way, same way. Sometimes good, sometimes not good. I'm mini grandma.
Yuko was close to her grandfather, too. He was still alive when she and her American boyfriend, Nick, decided to get married. She was worried about telling her grandfather. He was a bit of a throwback. During World War II, he'd trained as a kamikaze pilot.
He hates America. He doesn't want to do anything American things too, but we have to visit him.
When Yuko and Nick did visit and tell him of their plans, it went okay. They avoided serious subjects and kept things jokey. That's how her husband is, Yuko says, a joker, which, given the circumstances, isn't bad. But she says he's reluctant to talk, even with her, about her grandmother's story.
So he knows the story, but he never comment anything. He tried to be cool. He doesn't speak up. I would love to know what he thinks about something inside.
Not surprisingly, he didn't want to talk with me either. Yuko Arnold, that's her name now, she says she's very happy with Nick. They have two young children. She says in time she'll tell them all about their great-grandmother and the atomic bomb. She'll have to, she says, because they won't learn much about it in American schools. That episode of history, the world's first nuclear strike, does come up in conversations that Yuko has with American friends, but only when they ask her where in Japan she's from.
I came from Hiroshima. Everybody said, oh, atomic bomb. That's it. Yeah, that's it. I was like, okay. That's it. But if I speak up to talk to American, they just don't care or I don't know what they're feeling, but it's just not point to talking because they don't want to dig in that history.
Yuko Arnold has little choice but to dig into history. It's part of her family history. And she knows that she and her grandmother encourage each other to speak up when it feels easier to say nothing.
It's very hard to speak up about my grandma's story, but one day, hopefully I can speak up one day because I'm here.
The granddaughter of an atomic bomb survivor living in America. Japan is far away, but it feels a bit closer in the era of Skype and FaceTime, which is just as well because family means everything to both granddaughter and grandmother. As well as the family they share, Yuko has her American family, and Sueko Hada has the memory of her first family, the family that vanished in 1945. Just recently, she started dreaming of her father for the first time.
I was a daddy's girl 70 years ago. My father would take me everywhere. And it was that memory of him that showed up in my dream. He hugged me, and I said to him, "Oh, Daddy, I've been looking for you. Where were you?" And finally, I could cry. In his arms. I had such a very big cry. And then I woke up crying. But I was full of joy, too.
Hada wonders why her father has appeared to her after all these years. Did he want to tell her something? Friends say that maybe he's cheering her on because he knows how hard it's been for her to speak publicly, to convey to other people what it was like to live through such an ordeal. Hada thinks maybe that's what it is. What she knows for sure, though, is that this recurring dream is making her happy.
That's Patrick Cox. There are some big themes tied up in this story about survival and resilience, about what to remember and how and why. I thought it would be worth talking about some of these themes with someone who's been doing a lot of thinking about them himself.
I'm Dan Snyder. I'm the Associate Director for Research at the Walter H. Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford University. And my own research includes a project which I co-direct with our director, Kiwook Shin, called Divided Memories and Reconciliation. And it's a comparative study of how historical memory about the wartime period has been formed in Japan, China, Korea, and the United States.
Dan studied history before he became a foreign correspondent in Tokyo for the Christian Science Monitor. But even before that, long before that, he encountered post-wartime Japan.
Well, you know, I first went to Japan when I was 3 years old. My father was a diplomat, and I arrived in Japan in 1954. And that was a Japan that was still where you could very heavily feel the presence of American troops. There were still about 250,000 American troops based in Japan at that time. It was just after the end of the Korean War. So I remember a Tokyo when American soldiers were based right in the center of Tokyo. So the war is very much part of, and the aftermath of the war is very much part of my own memory of Japan. And I lived there a total of maybe 12, 13 years at different periods. And as a correspondent in the late 80s, I was mainly reporting on this idea of Japan on the rise, Japan is number one, and that evoked all of this imagery of the war, again, for Americans. You know, there was a lot of discussion about how the Japanese were pursuing their militaristic nature through economic competition, the sort of samurai businessman kind of imagery. So it's really hard to escape the memories of the war and the way they impact the way we perceive Japan and the way Americans interact with Japan. And I've always been fascinated with the war and wartime history. I was trained as a historian, so I like that subject matter. But I also like the idea of sort of breaking free of the lens of seeing Japan only as a horrific occupier and invader and aggressor. In the war, I knew it was a more complex thing. I knew that from my experience in Japan. So our approach was always comparative. We wanted to see, not just look at Japan and how the Japanese deal with the war, but we wanted to see how everybody dealt with the wartime past, because we really understood that everybody formed, we call it divided memories, everybody formed incomplete memories about the past, things that they focused on that were central to the identity of Japanese, or the identity of Koreans, or even the identity of Americans were not central to other people.
From Japan's perspective, invading and colonizing parts of East Asia was what a rising power did. It was what European powers had been doing for a couple of centuries, what the United States had done in the Philippines and elsewhere. China is trying to assert its regional dominance right now, strong-arming other claimants in the South and East China Seas. But Western powers in the 1940s were not used to an Asian power behaving this way, having the audacity to invade European and U.S. colonies in Southeast Asia. So Western powers blocked some Japanese exports, then froze Japan's assets so it couldn't buy oil. Japan lashed out, and the Pacific War was on.
The war in the Pacific, it's an uncomfortable war. It's an uncomfortable war for Americans.
Why is that?
Well, the war in Europe is this wonderful morality tale of good versus evil. And it's very clear. And you have the Holocaust as this kind of incredible driving justification for it, even though, of course, that wasn't why we went to war in Europe. The war in Asia, in the Pacific, first of all, it was overlain with a kind of racial narrative. And the wonderful historian John Dower did a wonderful book called War Without Mercy, in which he looked at the propaganda images from both sides. And both sides dehumanized their opponents. I mean, Japanese depictions of Americans and American depictions of Japanese. So it had this kind of racial quality to it. It was a race war. It was a brutal war. It was fought in jungles, in mud, in terrible conditions. Of course, it culminated in highly morally ambiguous act, the wholesale destruction of two Japanese cities. You know, we started the war saying we would not, in fact, this is part of the conventions of warfare, that we would not deliberately target civilians, certainly not from the air. President Roosevelt talked about it. That's why American bombers for a long time did not conduct nighttime bombing raids in Germany. They only bombed in the daylight, so they supposedly were going after specific military installations. And of course, in the case of Japanese cities, we insisted that and it was true that manufacturing facilities were spread throughout these Japanese cities. But I think you can go back and look at the writings of Curtis LeMay and others, and it's pretty clear he knew that they were going to kill large numbers of civilians. So it's not a story that actually is embraced in the same way in American sort of mythic historiography as the war in Europe is.
Yeah, and then there's even the question of, were the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki really necessary?
Well, I am not going to enter into or resolve the debate that continues amongst historians. I've read a lot of that material. I would say a few things. One is that actually in our teaching of history to our students, we do a much better job of exploring the question of, was this a justified act? I always, when I give talks on this, I always tell people the story of one of my sons who, in seventh grade, his social studies teacher was a wonderful teacher, and they opened the year of American history study with a 1 week. The kids had to all look at the question, was the atomic bombing justified? And also, was it justified to do the second bomb? And the first bomb was okay, but not the second bomb. And they all had to explore this and take a position and make a presentation in the class. And American textbooks, actually, the good ones, present these for and against arguments, which, by the way, is completely absent from Japanese textbooks. In fact, the exploration of what happened in the bombing is much more detailed in American textbooks that I've looked at than in Japanese textbooks. They're very matter of fact. Number of people killed. American textbooks include firsthand descriptions of victims and so on. So, to our credit, we've been a little better about confronting exactly that question. We're not going to resolve it. Mm-hmm. And you can make all the arguments that have been made again and again based on the historical evidence, even though it was known at the time. You know, people forget, we were in the fourth year of an awful war, a world war. American people were tired of war. They would not have wanted to see, after the victory in Europe, more hundreds, tens of thousands of Americans die in combat in the Pacific. They wanted to come home. They wanted to end the war. And the projections of American military leaders were that, and particularly after the invasion of Okinawa, which, by the way, my father was a combatant in the Battle of Okinawa, the casualties were very high, as they were at Iwo Jima, the other small piece of Japanese territory that Americans took. And they projected that, you know, to move in to take the main islands of Japan, the resistance would be even greater. So it wasn't unreasonable for Truman and others to say, look, you know, we have a chance to cut this short. We will not be treated kindly by the American people or by history if we don't do that. I think it's easier in retrospect to see that the Japanese were on the verge of surrender. But on the other hand, I've read the documentation of the debates that went on in Japan in those last days. The Japanese military leadership was not ready to give up, even after two atomic bombs. It was the emperor who finally put his thumb on the scales of the debate within the Japanese leadership on the side of the civilians who wanted to end the war. I think it's great to go and think about these things because, after all, we're living in a world where we're having to make lots of morally difficult decisions all the time about war and conflict. So why not go back to the past and see how tough this was on a much larger scale, after all? I mean, whether to use a drone to kill somebody is a far less portentous decision than whether to drop a bomb that can kill 150,000 people. Whether you say we were right or we were wrong, I don't think that's necessary. There's great value in just acknowledging the huge costs that are involved in warfare. And certainly, it's great to remind people, I use the word great carefully here, that the atomic bomb, nuclear weapons, are the most destructive weapon ever created by mankind. And they've only been used this twice, by the United States. And, you know, the Cold War ended, and we don't think about these things the way we did when I was a kid and we used to do drills for preparing for nuclear war. It's good to remind people, no, these things are out there. They haven't gone away. And the president, of course, this has been part of his goals of his administration since the earliest days. So I think it's appropriate that he ends his term in office by coming back to, I think, what was an important theme at the beginning in 2009.
You've been an advocate of President Obama visiting Hiroshima, and there are all kinds of good reasons why he should. You've just mentioned several of them. Do you see any downside? I mean, there has been some resistance, some hesitation in the U.S. Do you think there's any credence to those concerns?
Well, I mean, there's a clear, huge political risk. And we already can see Fox News going after the president for doing this. This is, the apology tour. And when, after all, we had the very unpleasant experience of the exhibit at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in the mid-90s when they put the Enola Gay on exhibit, and the people who were mounting the exhibit simply acknowledged that there was controversy over the decision to drop the bomb, and it created a huge firestorm, and they were forced to revise even the exhibit descriptions. So it's a highly sensitive issue. It remains so, and I give the president credit for having the courage, and possibly you could only do this as you're leaving office, to do this despite the fact that it's going to generate a fair amount of criticism. So, no question, there's a downside, but I don't think it matches what we gain from both a moral and historical responsibility point of view, as well as from advancing and making people conscious of the agenda of eliminating nuclear weapons.
It's kind of subjective, right, whether there's a downside. I mean, it's seen by Fox News, it's seen by conservatives in the States, some, that, you know, this makes America look weaker. But I think the question really is, does it? And do you actually gain more in soft power by going? Plus, it's just the decent thing to do, the decent, compassionate thing to do.
I give you the example of the decision that was made to apologize for the imprisonment of Japanese Americans during the war, which took a long time to do, and we paid actually compensation to those people. But having done that, it's useful because you can then turn around to others, including the Japanese, and say, hey, look, we did something wrong and we acknowledged it. How about you do that? Of course, one can also say, yeah, we never told the Vietnamese sorry for the war. The Vietnamese didn't ask us to say sorry. Well, we've managed to achieve reconciliation with Vietnam despite that. It's not always the thing you need to do, but I think it is absolutely a form of soft power. And more importantly, that war remains an incredible touchstone for every society that was engaged in it. It's amazing how much that war has such reverberation, continuing reverberation. The French are still debating the question of collaboration. Did the French actually send Jews to the camps without the being told to do so by the Nazis? The Poles are engaged in these debates as well. Russians are rewriting their wartime history. So, you know, historical memory is not just about what the people who are the participants in events remember. It's more importantly how societies, how nations construct a memory long after everybody who lived through these is gone. And that'll be a tragedy in some ways because their memory is the most powerful one, including for their descendants. The wartime generation is actually much more willing to look at these issues. They went through it. They have strong memories, visual memories of what war meant. The problem is younger generations and all these people, they have only the constructed memory. And to some degree, that's harder to deal with. It's more nationalistic. It's more extreme in some ways. It doesn't view the other in a nuanced way. So it's going to get worse rather than better, actually, when the wartime generation passes. So I think you have to have a sense of urgency about dealing with this. So every act that sort of says, well, let's place a marker here and let's say, yeah, we know what happened here. Here's some truths that we acknowledge, even when we still continue to debate the decisions that were made by our leaders 70 years ago. And as far as Japan is concerned, what people don't realize is there's no such thing as the Japanese. It's a problem always, you know, people, the Japanese think this. And I run into this all the time in talking to people in China and Korea. The Japanese say this about the war. I said, no, there are some Japanese who say that. There are other Japanese who say totally different things. Japan is an open society, a democratic society with a vibrant civil society, huge debate. It's just a lot of it not visible from the outside. It's conducted in Japanese, which most people can't understand. And Japanese aren't particularly interested in explaining what they're talking about and thinking about. So I think it's good for people to see the debates that continue within Japan. I mean, they're still fighting about this stuff within their own society, and they probably will for a long time.
So what are the competing narratives within Japan about the war?
There are three main narratives in Japan, and one that many people are sort of aware of, that is, it's the conservative revisionist narrative, which you can see at the museum that's attached to the Yasukuni Shrine, the Shinto Shrine to Japan's war dead in Tokyo. And that's a narrative that still wants to justify the war, denies the idea that Japan was an aggressor, even evokes the notion that Japan was in fact liberating Asia from Western imperialism, and that even the war with the United States, the war in the Pacific, was in some sense a response to American pressure and provocation. The second narrative is a kind of the left-wing opposite of that, and you can see that, for instance, if you go to the Okinawa Peace Museum, and in that view, the Okinawans were the victims not only of the invading American army in 1945, but maybe more so of the Japanese Imperial Army, which, among other things, forced Okinawan civilians into the front lines or even forced them to commit mass suicide. In the left-wing Japanese narrative, there's an interestingly very clear sense of guilt about Japan's aggression in Asia against Chinese and other countries in Asia, and certainly for what they did in Korea, less so vis-a-vis the United States, because in that left-wing narrative, Japan, the United States, it's kind of a case of inter-imperialist rivalry. But still, it's certainly very clear about the notion that the problem was the wartime militarist regime in Japan. That's the enemy as far as they're concerned. But the main narrative, the one that remains, I think, the dominant narrative for Japanese, I call pacifist narrative. And that's a narrative that says war itself is bad. The war was a disastrous mistake for Japan. The country was destroyed. Its leaders led Japan astray. And in some sense, war is the enemy in the abstract. And in some ways, all of these narratives share a sense of victimization. Even the left-wing narrative sees the Japanese people as the victims of their own regime. But certainly the pacifist narrative is very strongly a victim narrative. We were not just an aggressor, we were a victim. And the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the firebombings of Japanese cities, which were horrendous, embody this sense of victimization. Although it isn't a case that it's anti-American. I think it's more, as I said, war itself is the horror.
So given these different memories of the war, different narratives about the war, what do you think President Obama's visit to Hiroshima will mean in Japan?
I think it'll be extremely well received. And after all, Japanese and Americans have, in some ways, of course, fundamentally achieved reconciliation after the war. But it was a reconciliation without, in some ways, dealing with probably the most painful issue of the war, which was the decision to use the atomic bomb. You know, at the time of the occupation of Japan from 1945 to 1952, American occupation authorities didn't allow the Japanese to even show photographs and films and so on of the damage that was done in the atomic bombings. That conversation was really suppressed by the American occupiers. It only really emerges after the end of occupation, the restoration of Japanese sovereignty. And Americans don't want to deal with this issue. Was it justified? But also the effects of the bombing. And one of the things an interesting thing, we were doing a study of films about the war for our project. And it's interesting that no American filmmaker has ever made a film about the atomic bombing itself, what happened. There have been films made about the decision to use the bomb, about the crew on the Enola Gay, what the Manhattan Project, but nobody ever made a film about the atomic bombing. Whereas in Japan, there are many such movies, and Japanese engaged in huge amount of self-examination about this, some of it, of course, to justify their sense of victimization. So I think for the Japanese, an American president's willingness to at least acknowledge this event, I don't think he has to formally apologize. I don't think Japanese are looking for that, but they want some acknowledgement of the horror of this event. It has huge reverberation still as a symbol for Japanese people. And if you go to the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum, every Japanese school child, I think, is taken on a trip to that museum or to Nagasaki or both. It's just part of the rituals of life. There are movies that everybody watches. This is a deeply embedded part of Japanese historical memory. And so I think it has a lot of emotional meaning to see an American president stand finally in front of the memorial, the remains of the dome, which everybody in Japan knows, and just to, as Secretary of State Kerry did some weeks ago, acknowledge what happened. I think that has meaning.
You moderated an event here recently that included Yoichi Funabashi, the former editor-in-chief of Asahi Shimbun, a highly respected journalist and commentator in Japan, currently the founder and head of the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation. He said something really interesting and surprising to me.
I think some right-wingers in Japan would not like this to happen because Japan will be reciprocated for the Japan's prime minister to be expected to visit Pearl Harbor.
That there's sort of almost a moral pressure that if one side is going to make a gesture like this, that the other side has to. And then where does it go from there? Do you have to go to Nanjing? Do you think that that's a concern that actually is felt in elite circles in Japan? Do you think that it's perhaps expected in the region?
I am myself on the record advocating exactly that. That is that this visit should take place in the context of the broader issue of historical reconciliation in Northeast Asia, and that it's a good thing for the American president to do this, to show our willingness to confront, you know, some painful issues in our past, whether we say sorry or whether we in any way try and second-guess the decisions that were made in 1945. In any case, it's a some degree, it's acknowledging that this issue exists and that that does set a certain moral example, and it does implicitly and perhaps explicitly, if certain people in the government choose to make it so, set an example for the Japanese leadership. And that's a very sensitive subject still for right-wing conservatives in Japan, and the Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Shinzo Abe, is very much in that sort of historical revisionist camp himself, personally. They reject the idea that Japan was an aggressor, which, of course, was a judgment of the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal, but in their view, that was victor's justice. To go to Pearl Harbor is to sort of acknowledge Japan's status as an aggressor. So that's a sensitive subject. There's also the question of, would you then be willing to go to China, acknowledge the massacre in Nanjing, go to Korea, apologize directly to Korean women who are dragooned into brothels by the Japanese Imperial Army? I think there is some degree that kind of pressure will be created out of this. And as a result, I think there were people in and around the Prime Minister's office, I don't know about the Prime Minister himself, who weren't exactly enthusiastic, actually, about the president doing this. But that's precisely why I think it's a good idea. I'm all for putting that kind of pressure on Japanese leadership, because they, too, have to confront the past. And the whole problem about the war is that it doesn't go away, not in Asia and, frankly, not in Europe either. And Americans have a difficulty dealing with some of the issues of the war as well. We've tended to bury some of these things.
Sure. It brings up some really interesting and thorny bigger issues about what you remember, what you put aside, what it takes to reconcile, what it takes to move on. I mean, the U.S. and Japan are now allies, are very close allies. China and Japan are important trading partners with each other. But within that second relationship, there's also a lot of usage of the memories of the war for political purposes. There is genuine pain that's felt, but the Chinese government also kind of amps up emotion around Japan as aggressor, Japan as human rights abuser. And there have been demonstrations in 2005, 2007, 2012, increasingly orchestrated by the government. If Japan were to feel under pressure to start to acknowledge what it did during the war, couldn't that be seen in the region as a sign of weakness, a sign of now you're kind of being put into your place? I mean, certainly the Chinese government would like to see that happen.
Well, that's a dilemma for the Japanese. I mean, they're confronting a China that certainly has ambitions to be the dominant power in East Asia. And the sort of axis of that ambition is the Sino-Japanese rivalry. You're at a moment in history when the two greatest nations in East Asia are simultaneously very powerful countries. Now, one may be on the rise, the other may be somewhat stagnant, but still extremely powerful. And that's never happened before in the whole history of Asia. It's always been one ascendant and one very descendant, China many centuries ago, Japan since the 19th century, and now we have them both at the same time. And unquestionably, the wartime period is essential to the formation of national identity in all of these countries. Most of the, for instance, war museums that you see now in China that are very focused on the anti-Japanese war, they were all built or redone in the mid-90s onward, including the Nanjing Museum, mm-hmm. which was completely redone in the late 90s. The communists never talked much about the Nanjing Massacre, and the reason was they weren't there. That was a battle fought by the Kuomintang, by the KMT, and it's not a heroic story. They only liked the heroic story of the communist guerrillas who are fighting the Japanese and defeating them, and of course their main claim was, we beat the Japanese in alliance with the Soviet Union, not with the United States, not with the Allies. So that was the narrative before. So they didn't talk about it. They didn't talk about the Nanjing Massacre as this moment of victimization at all. This is a new narrative that they've constructed. And yes, it's obviously politically motivated in the sense that it's about creating legitimacy for those who rule China today. You know, they're building an idea of themselves. They are the people that reversed the, you know, century of humiliation. They brought great China back up off its knees. It's just a very important part of the kind of patriotic ideology, which now has replaced the sort of discredited ideology of Maoism. But on the other hand, I think this has become deeply embedded in Chinese consciousness. So it's hard. You can't turn it on and turn it off so easily. The Chinese Communist Party at times does allow people to express themselves, but they almost always get nervous when that happens. So they unleash anti-Japanese demonstrators, and then they pull them back. You know, I don't know that they really fundamentally control this narrative anymore.
I've thought a lot as a foreign correspondent about the politics of memory. And let's be clear, Japan does have something to apologize for in China and elsewhere in Asia. It caused many millions of deaths, some 20 million in China alone. But Japan is not the only Asian power that has apologizing to do. The Chinese Communist Party itself caused more deaths than the Japanese did, and they're not showing any interest in apologizing or even acknowledging that some of these things happened. Then there's also the American experience, the way Americans remember World War II, and particularly the war with Japan. And that brings us back to President Obama's visit.
People always point to, when they talk about reconciliation, and academics use this term, thin reconciliation and thick reconciliation. So thin reconciliation is the formal statements that governments have issued, so the formal apologies issued by the Japanese Prime Minister in 1995 or at other times. And thick reconciliation is the reconciliation that engages civil society, the whole population. In order to get from thin to thick, to some degree you need not only the involvement of civil society, which you do have, actually. I mean, NGOs in all these countries are actually interacting with each other quite a bit more than you would think looking at the official level. But you need the kind of dramatic gestures, visible events that really create a kind of emotional resonance for the population at large. And the example that people always point to is the famous Willy Brandt's visit to Warsaw in 1970, the so-called deep knee fall, where Brandt, in a apparently spontaneous moment, went to his knees at the memorial to the Warsaw Ghetto uprising and as a moment of contrition and apology. And that image, just the photograph of that, remains a very powerful image. You can see it everywhere. You go put it in Google, it'll show up like that. And so I'm anticipating that the biggest impact of President Obama's visit to Hiroshima will not be the statement that he issues. It'll be an image of him bowing at the memorial to those whose lives were lost. I think that'll probably be forever emblazoned in Japanese minds.
It doesn't change the past, but it may change the way the past is remembered and understood, both in Japan and in the United States, maybe even beyond. That can help shape a century. And that's our podcast. For more on this story, go to pri.org/century, where you'll find a print version of this story, photos, and links to related stories and websites. To hear and read more of Patrick Cox's excellent series on Hiroshima and historical memory, go to pri.org/Hiroshima. Dan Snyder and his colleague Giwok Shin have a book coming out soon called Divergent Memories. It covers some of the same issues Dan discussed with me and more, based on interviews with historians, filmmakers, and others in Japan, China, Korea, and the United States. I'm looking forward to reading it. Thanks, as ever, for listening. If you're not already subscribing to the podcast, please do. Go to iTunes or your other preferred podcast app and click the subscribe button. It's as easy as that. If you prefer to stream, you can listen to all of our episodes on SoundCloud, Stitcher, or on pri.org/century. Comments, suggestions, message me on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad. That's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Whose Century Is It? Is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's sponsored by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with a new episode. Come on back and listen in.